set the pen on the desk and folded his hands in front of him.
"Do you know where your son is getting the drugs you think he's taking, Professor Essa Crocera? Or what kind of drugs he's using?"
Asked a question she was not prepared for, she evaded Brunetti's glance and stared at her knees. Brunetti hated what drugs did to people, hated their corroding influence on even the best of spirits, yet he lived with three people who believed that they should all be declared legal. Easy answers, easy answers. Why did people always want easy answers? Drugs changed everything. He'd had women offer themselves to him, men offer him their wives, even their daughters, if only he would not arrest them and put them in a place where they thought they could not find drugs. He'd once seen a woman still wearing her bridal gown, dead of an overdose, and once he'd been called to an apartment where a 3-year-old boy had died of starvation and neglect during the week-long heroin party his parents had treated themselves to, with money stolen from all 4 of the dead child's grandparents.
"No," he heard her say.
After another long pause, and in a much different voice, she added,
"If I asked him, he'd lie to me."
Brunetti watched her accept this, and then she added, explaining it to herself as well as to him,
"I don't know how I know that, but it's true."
She put her hand to her forehead and sat in silence. He was again staring out the window when he heard her say, voice rough and almost inaudible,
"He's my baby, and I don't know what to do."
He turned back to her. The sight of the woman's tears slipping under her fingers and dripping onto her jacket, where the wool quickly absorbed them, propelled Brunetti to his feet. He went over to the window and stared at the facade of the church. San Lorenzo, a martyr. Brunetti's father had died a long and terrible death from cancer in a hospital run by people who viewed human suffering as a fine way to pave the way to salvation, and who had thus refused to give him painkillers in the last days of his life. 3 days before his father's death, Brunetti, by then already a commissario di polizia, had stolen a box of ampules of morphine from the room where the police kept confiscated drugs and weapons, and had administered them at 8-hour intervals to his dying father. After his father died, in peace and in the arms of his younger son, Brunetti had gone home and broken open the remaining ampules and flushed all the morphine down the kitchen sink. He believed very little in an absolute sense, but he knew suffering was always wrong.
"Can you do anything?"
she asked in her normal voice from the other side of the room. She was again capable of speech, so Brunetti went back to his desk.
"I can try to find out if drugs are being sold at his school and who's selling them," Brunetti said.
He couldn't remember having heard any rumors about the Albertini, but to find out would at least be a place to begin. Professoressa Crocera shifted in her chair, suddenly restless, perhaps eager to leave now that someone else was going to take care of things. No, that was not to do her justice.
"Could you give me your phone number?" Brunetti asked.
As she did, Brunetti wrote it in his notebook, then wrote above it, Albertini, just in case someone found his book and was curious about whom he had spoken to. He realized that, as there was so little he could do, there was nothing else to say. One glance at her told him she had little power to tell him anything more, and far less willingness. Brunetti got to his feet and thanked her for coming to see him. She seemed surprised by this badly disguised dismissal, but allowed herself to be accompanied to the door. In an attempt to make up for his sharpness when questioning her, Brunetti smiled and promised to do what he could, not telling her how little that was. After she was gone, he went back to the window to think about the visit and about this woman's sorrow. He was relieved to see that the rain had stopped. Chapter 5. After lunch, Brunetti phoned Vianello and asked him to come up. When the inspector arrived, Brunetti offered him a seat and told him at some length about his meeting with Professoressa Crosera. Vianello nodded and asked,
"The kids go to the Albertini?"
"Does that make a difference?"
The inspector crossed his legs and waved one foot in the air.
"It might have, 5 years ago, but I don't think it does any more. They can find drugs everywhere now."
He uncrossed his legs and set his foot on the floor. Brunetti suddenly noticed how much gray there was in his friend's hair, and how his face seemed to have grown thinner.
"It used to be that the kids in the private schools used them less, but that's changing. At least that's what I've been told."
"By whom?" Brunetti asked, realizing too late that he should not have. Everyone at the Questura kept the name of their sources to themselves. After a moment, Vianello said mildly,
"By someone who knows. He told me all the schools have the problem now, to one degree or another."
Brunetti knew this, of course, just as he knew that the air in the city in winter was polluted far beyond the limits which some European scientific agency had established for human safety. But so long as he didn't smell it or feel it in his lungs, Brunetti ignored it, aware that there was nothing he could do to avoid the air except leave the city. So too with drugs. So long as it wasn't your own kids.
"Thank God we were born when we were,"
he surprised Vianello by saying.
"What does that mean?"
"That there were fewer drugs around when we were in our teens. Or at least they didn't seem so normal the way they do now. Some of my friends tried them, but I can't remember anyone who used them all the time."
When Vianello nodded in agreement, Brunetti added,
"Besides, I didn't have the money for them." "I tried hashish once," Vianello said, looking at his feet. "You never told me."
Vianello laughed at Brunetti's tone and said,
"I tried to keep some secrets, Guido."
"What happened?"
"I was at a party at a friend's house, and I was given some herbal tea,"
Vianello explained. Brunetti found his use of the passive voice interesting.
"You didn't smoke it?" "No. If I'd gone home smelling of it, my father would have..."
"Would have what?" Brunetti asked, aware of how seldom Vianello spoke of his father.
"I don't know. Threatened to knock me into next week, probably."
"Only threatened?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes,"
Vianello answered, without hesitation or explanation, then asked,
"What did Professoressa Crosera want?"
Putting aside his curiosity to know the rest of Vianello's story, Brunetti sifted through obvious reasons and real reasons and finally answered,
"I think she wanted us to make the problem go away. All we had to do was arrest the people who sell her son drugs."
Vianello raised his eyebrows at this.
"Even though she offered no concrete information," Brunetti said. "She wouldn't tell me who told her daughter that Sandro was in trouble, and she made it clear there was no specific mention of drugs."
He added, his irritation audible,
"I don't know what she thinks we're supposed to do." "It's like that Greek thing you've mentioned,"
Vianello said to Brunetti's absolute confusion.
"The one with the Latin name."
"Deus ex machina?"
Brunetti asked, suddenly understanding and smiling at Vianello's reference.
"How helpful that would be. A god flies in, grabs up the problem, and takes it away into the skies with him."
He gave the god time to fly out of the room before he returned to less fanciful solutions.
"Unless she helps us by talking to her son, there's not much we can do." "And so?"
Vianello asked. When Brunetti didn't answer, Vianello got to his feet.
"Let's have a coffee."
The only interesting thing that happened during the rest of the day was a telephone call from one of Brunetti's informants, who told him that a visit should be made to the fish market. Not the one at Rialto, but the wholesale one at Tronchetto, the following morning. Brunetti thanked him and said he'd inform the local police and the food fraud branch of the Carabinieri.
"Take them to look at the clams," the man said in his usual cheerful manner. "And perhaps check the tuna. It's traveling without a passport."
He gave a sanctimonious tisk, 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 and hung up. Brunetti had never met this man, although they had spoken on the phone for years. He had first called Brunetti's telefonino number 6 or 7 years before, ignoring Brunetti's question of how he'd obtained the number and saying he had some information for him. His call led to the arrest of two men who had robbed a jewelry shop 3 days before. When he'd called some months later, Brunetti had tried, clothing his question in euphemism and discretion, to ask how he wanted to be paid, which question provoked a burst of laughter.
"I don't want anything," the man had insisted. "I just want the fun of doing it."
Brunetti had demurred at asking what fun it could possibly be, and decided to accept the information as the man intended it. A gift. The man called 3 or 4 times a year, always with accurate information that led to an arrest, but, surprisingly, never about the same crime twice. Fake Parma ham coming in from Hungary. 2 tons of contraband cigarettes landed on a beach near Grado. The man who had stolen an X-ray machine from a dentist's office in Merano. Even the 2 Romanian conmen who had cheated a series of old women into paying what they persuaded them were supplementary electricity bills. Brunetti knew nothing about his caller other than what he had inferred from the familiarity he showed with crime and criminals. It suggested someone who had in the past taken part in crimes such as the ones he reported, but who had, for reasons Brunetti could not imagine, turned against his former colleagues. This would explain the accuracy of the information in his calls, as well as his complete lack of indignation about the crimes he reported. It might be a private vendetta, thieves falling out, or he could well be a criminal himself, interested only in limiting the competition. Even apart from the value of his calls, Brunetti had grown sufficiently fond of the man to feel concern for his safety, and hoped he had given thought to the risk he was running. After he passed on the informant's message about the fish market, Brunetti decided he had done enough for the day and could leave early. Without telling anyone, he turned right when he left the Questura, then left over the first bridge and away from the center of the city, letting his feet decide where to take him. He worked his way out to the Bacino, turned left, and headed down farther into Castello, still with no idea of where he wanted to go. He turned into Via Garibaldi, surprised to find so many people on the street. Had November become a tourist month while he wasn't paying attention? 100 meters on, he calmed down at the realization that almost everyone around him was Venetian. He didn't need to hear them speaking dialect. Their clothing and the unconscious ease with which they walked, not on the alert for something quaint to photograph or a tiny shop where they could find real local handicrafts, told him that they were. His pace slowed, and he went into a bar for a coffee, but changed it to a glass of white wine when he discovered a small bowl with pretzels on the counter. He glanced at the headlines on a copy of the Gazzettino, and was puzzled by how familiar it all sounded, until he glanced at the date and saw that it was yesterday's edition. He closed it, wondering how it was that every issue could contain at least 8 pages with headlines that blared news of profound schisms and new formations that would completely change the face of national politics, at the same time as nothing changed and nothing happened. Brunetti fished a euro out of his pocket and placed it on the bar.
"How is it that we haven't had an elected government for more than 5 years?" he asked.
It wasn't really a question, merely an attempt to voice his perplexity. the barman put the coin in the till and rang up a receipt for Brunetti. Placing it on the counter next to the empty glass, he said,
"So long as we have football on television, no one much cares if we elect a government or if some ancient politician appoints one."
Brunetti, who had not been expecting an answer, stood still and considered the man's explanation.
"Joe,"
he said, thinking that his agreement could best, perhaps only, be expressed in Veneziano. He left the bar and continued down Via Garibaldi and deeper into the rabbit warren of Castello. He didn't get home until after 7, having walked as far as San Pietro in Castello, where he went in to light a candle for his mother's soul, being of a mind that doing it was probably as good for his own soul as was the glass of wine. The faint odor of cloves greeted him when he got home, luring him into the kitchen to see what Paolo was up to. Spezzatino di manzo with exotic spices, it seemed. And, if he knew anything about vegetables, cavolini di Bruxelles alla besciamella.
"If I promise to clean my plate, will you run off to Tahiti with me for a week of wild excess?"
he asked as he put his arms around Paola and nuzzled at the back of her neck.
"If you promise to shave before you kiss my neck again, it's a deal," she said,
wriggling away from him and rubbing at his kiss with the palm of her right hand.
"Though I think there's small risk you won't clean your plate."
The smile she gave him as she said this removed any sting from her words. Having the night before finished reading the Oresteia for the first time in 20 years, he went to Paola's study to consult the shelves that contained his books to decide what he would read next. He decided to stay with drama, and bent closer to the bookshelves to study the titles. Still not free of the memory of his meeting with Professoressa Crosera and her terrible fear for her son, he was struck by how often the Greeks, too, worried about their children. Most of the plays seemed to deal with the devastation children brought upon their parents. Or, he had to admit after a moment, parents upon their children. He saw the plays of Euripides and recalled a production of Medea he'd seen in London, dragged there by Paola, what was it, 20 years ago? More? His eyes remained on the spines of the books, but his memory went to the final scene, she on an elevated platform above the stage, clinging to her 2 children. And then, instead of carrying them off stage to do the wicked deed, she drew a knife and stabbed and killed them both. Even at the memory of the scene, Brunetti winced and felt a stab to his own stomach. During his career, Brunetti had watched as a man was murdered in cold blood, and he had seen other people die. The Greeks were right. They knew. We aren't meant to see such things happen. They were meant to horrify, not entertain. No, not Medea. He reached forward and pulled out the plays of Sophocles instead. Both children were home for dinner, and the sight of them confirmed Brunetti in his decision to avoid reading Medea. Without thinking, he reached across the table and put his hand on Raffi's arm. His son looked up, surprised. Brunetti fingered the cloth of Raffi's sweater and said,
"I don't remember seeing this before."
"Mamma brought it back from Rome last winter. Do you like it?"
Brunetti took the opportunity this question offered him to remove his hand and shift back to get a better look at the sweater.
"It's very nice."
He looked across at Paola and said,
"Good choice,"
and then asked for more spezzatino. "I will not ask them about drugs. I will not ask them about drugs." Reciting this mantra, Brunetti ate his spezzatino, then asked for another piece. Chiara asked Raffi if he'd take a look at her physics homework and tell her if her answers made any sense.
"I don't understand why I have to study this," she said. "I'm never going to have to think about it again once the class is over."
Isn't it supposed to train your mind by showing you the laws that govern the universe? Brunetti asked.
Did you take it in school?
Chiara asked him.
Of course.
Did you learn...
She began, but then changed her question to...
Do you remember anything?
Unasked, Paula got to her feet and leaned over to spoon two pieces of cauliflower onto his plate, giving Brunetti time to organize an answer. Deciding to tell the truth, he said,
I remember some of the laws, and that at the time I enjoyed being made to think in a different manner about phenomena I'd never understood. It made me look at the world in a new way. I think I found it comforting that there was order in what happened in the universe, even on the grandest scale. And rules.
If what our professor tells us is right, Chiara began, then a lot of what you were taught has been, what's the word? Repealed. And I'm being taught new rules or laws of nature. What's to say that my children won't listen to their teachers repeal all the laws I'm being taught now?
Rafi broke in to say,
There are big rules, and they're not going to change. The universe isn't all some random system that does what it wants and that we'll never understand.
The rules also show that the gods can't interfere where they want and do what they want,
Paula added, no doubt happy to have been given the opportunity to take a gratuitous whack at religion in any form.
But it's a year of my life,
Chiara whined, as though she were tied down and suffering the bastinado.
Would you rather be taught how to knit and darn socks the way I was?
Paula demanded, reducing the choices to two. Brunetti summoned up the image of Paula darning a sock, attempted to stifle his reaction, but quickly lost control of himself and burst into a fit of giggles. He slapped his hand over his mouth, but that proved useless. If anything, the sight of her astonished glance made things worse for him, and he was forced to close his eyes and press his hand harder. All that did was squeeze tears from his eyes until he had to put his napkin to them. No one at the table spoke. The kids kept their eyes on their plates while Paula studied the top of Brunetti's lowered head. He wiped his eyes and put his napkin back on his lap, then looked across at her.
"I'm tempted to send you to your room without dessert, Guido,"
she said amiably, meeting his glance.
"I confess, I was never taught to darn socks, but that's because I refused to take the class in home management."
To ward off any accusation of dishonesty the children might launch, she went on.
"I invented darning as an example of the sort of thing I was forced to do that wasted my time when I was at school. I hope you'll consider it the rhetorical flourish it was."
Her explanation apparently concluded, she gave a gracious wave of her hand to her children, who nodded. Paula smiled, and all the world was gay. Chapter 6 As if the departing tourists had decided to take crime with them, little of it was reported to the Questura during the next week. Brunetti called a friend at the Carabinieri to ask about the situation of drugs in the schools, and was told that it was already under investigation by a special squad based in Treviso. His conscience salved, Brunetti sought no farther information. He spent some time reading through the files that had accumulated on his desk, five of them containing the CVs of people who were to rotate to the staff of the Questura in February. He found time to go to the firing range in Mestre to fulfill last year's obligation to practice shooting at least once a year. There he was encouraged to try out new pistols. Signorina Elettra somehow having found sufficient funds to update and upgrade the pistols issued to commissari and higher ranks. After test firing three of them, then his own service weapon, Brunetti decided that one of the new pistols was lighter and smaller, and thus would be less of an encumbrance in those few times he remembered to carry it. The officer in charge was a tall, robust man, probably serving his last few years before retirement. He told Brunetti that the pistol he preferred would be available either in May or perhaps not until the end of the summer. Brunetti slid the pistol across the counter, slipped his own weapon into its holster, and put it inside his briefcase.
"Should I call you?" he asked.
He snapped his bag closed and prepared to leave.
"No, commissario. I've been in touch with Signorina Elettra, and I'll call her when they arrive. You can come back then and try it out. See if you still prefer the new model."
Brunetti thanked him and snapped his briefcase closed.
"Well, I look forward to seeing you then."
The thought came to Brunetti, and he asked, "What happens to our old guns?"
"You mean the ones we replace, sir?"
"Yes. They're sent to a foundry and melted down."
Brunetti nodded, pleased by the answer.
"Better than having them lying around somewhere."
"Absolutely, sir. Guns are nothing but trouble."
Brunetti put out his hand.
"I'll remember you told me that," he said, and smiled to suggest he was joking.
Brunetti disliked guns, disliked having his, had felt uncomfortable the few times he carried it, and had never in all these years so much as pointed it at a person. It often spent weeks sequestered in a locked metal box at the back of the shelf where he kept his underwear. The bullets lived in a similar locked box, sharing a shelf with the cleaning products in the closet behind the kitchen. Life continued peaceful and dull, until the phone woke Brunetti one night from a profound, dreamless sleep. When he finally picked it up, it seemed to have been ringing forever.
"See?"
he asked, still dull with sleep, but aware of what the call would have to be.
"Guido?"
a woman's voice asked. It took him a second to recognize Claudia Griffoni, his colleague and friend.
"Yes, Claudia, what is it?"
"I'm at the hospital," she said. "A man may have been attacked."
"Where?"
he asked. He got out of bed and went into the corridor. He reached inside to pull the door closed.
"Near San Stai."
"Badly?"
"It looks that way."
"What happened?"
"Someone called the hospital about an hour ago, saying he'd found a man lying at the bottom of a bridge. He thought he'd fallen. There was blood on the pavement."
"But," Brunetti asked, "why else would she call him?"
"But when they got him here, the doctor at Pronto Soccorso found marks on the inside of his left wrist that might have been made by fingernails, as though someone had grabbed him."
Before Brunetti could ask, she said,
"He took samples. There was a lot of blood on the ground where he'd hit his head. The doctor says he has a concussion. From the look of it, he says he must have hit the metal railing when he fell. He's trying to find out how bad the damage is."
She drew a breath.
"They called the Questura. I'm on call tonight."
"Is the bridge sealed off?"
"Yes. Two Vigili Urbani were on patrol at Rialto, so they came. They'll see that no one gets near the bridge. The crime scene crews are on the way."
"Witnesses?"
he asked. She made a noise.
"You want me there?"
"There or here," she said.
"Tell me what bridge it is, and I'll go there first, then come to the hospital."
"Wait a minute. I've got it written down."
He heard fumbling from the other end.
"Ponte del Forner," she said. "It's..."
"I know where it is," he cut her short.
"Do you want me to send a boat?"
"Thanks, Claudia, but no. I can get there in 15 minutes. It's faster."
"All right. I'll see you here, then, after."
Brunetti switched off the phone and pushed the bedroom door open. He set the phone back in its stand and walked over to the bed. The top half of Paola's blonde head on her pillow seemed to glow in the light cast by the full moon. He turned on his bedside lamp, saw that it was almost 2, and went to the armadio and got dressed in front of it. He tossed his pajamas on his side of the bed and sat to put on his shoes. He turned off his light, gave his eyes a chance to adjust to the moonlight, then walked around the bed and put his hand on Paola's shoulder.
"Paola! Paola!"
Her breathing changed, and she turned her head sideways to face him. She made an inquisitive noise.
"I have to go out,"
she grunted.
"I'll call."
She grunted again. He thought of telling her he loved her, but it was not the sort of declaration he wanted to hear answered with a grunt. In the hallway, he put on his coat and let himself out quietly. The night was thick with caigo, that peculiar Venetian dampness that fills the lungs, obscures vision, and leaves a viscous, slippery coating on the pavement. He walked towards Rialto, half savoring the sense of being in an abandoned city wrapped in something more than haze but less than fog. He stopped and listened, but there were no footsteps to be heard. He moved off again towards Campo Sant'Apollinare. He was approaching the aftermath of violence and pain and injury, but he felt no distress, only the calm that came of being in his city as it once had been, a sleepy provincial town where very little happened and the streets were often empty. As Brunetti entered the campo, a man appeared and passed him by, eyes on the ground. In front of the church he saw another man and a woman walking slowly hand in hand, their heads swiveling from side to side, enchanted. As they grew closer, he heard the thud of their hiking boots, and when they were abreast of him, he saw their heavy backpacks. They were blind to him, as well they should be, he thought. He traversed the campo, making his way towards San Cassiano. The near darkness obscured many reference points, but Brunetti had given things over to his feet and the memory they had of these narrow bridges and the even narrower calli towards which they led. He passed San Cassiano on his right, over the bridge, down, right, left, another bridge, and 50 meters ahead of him he saw the sudden glare and the fog of a torch pointed in his direction.
"You there. The bridge is closed," a male voice said at normal volume. "Go back to Calle della Regina."
He spoke Veneziano, as if only a local would be walking in this part of the city at this time of the night.
"It's me, Brunetti," he said, and kept walking.
"Ah, good morning, commissario," the man said,
and the beam of his flashlight lifted for a moment as he raised his hand in salute. For no reason Brunetti could understand, the fog seemed less dense nearer to the bridge. The officer must have realized it as well, for he turned off the flashlight and reattached it to his belt. He was one of the Vigili Urbani, Brunetti noticed, not one of his own men. It was then that he heard the noise and the male voices from behind the officer.
"Is that the crime squad?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes, sir."
As the man spoke, the fog cleared on the other side of the bridge, and Brunetti saw the light blooming there. He walked towards the bridge, the man falling into step beside him. He stopped at the first step and called out,
"This is Brunetti. Can I come up?"
"Yes, sir,"
a voice called back, and Brunetti walked to the top of the bridge, noting the thick metal handrail. The vigile stayed behind and went back to the beginning of the calle to stop people from entering. From the top, Brunetti saw two of the white-suited technicians following their neat patterns, checking the ground for anything that might have belonged to the victim or his presumed attacker. Ambrosio, one of Bocchese's men, tall and frighteningly thin, even in his puffy white overalls, came up the steps towards Brunetti.
"We're checking to see if anything else fell when he did."
"The doctor told Grifoni it looked as if someone might have grabbed him and pulled him down the steps," Brunetti said.
"Yes, sir,"
Ambrosio said in the bland voice the tech people used when responding to their colleagues' suppositions.
She called and told us. We're looking for signs of some other person or what might have happened.
Ambrosio waved down at the area where his colleagues were still at work.
Any witnesses? Brunetti asked.
Ambrosio shrugged.
Since we got here, a couple of people have leaned out of their windows to see what we're doing, but when we ask them if they heard anything, no one has.
Questioning possible witnesses was not the kind of work the crime squad was supposed to be doing, and so he said,
"We'll send some people over tomorrow to go from door to door."
He knew both Il Gazzettino and La Nuova Venezia would report the incident, and he made a note to have someone call the editorial offices and ask them to insert a request that anyone who had heard or seen a disturbance near San Stai call the Questura. Such requests seldom elicited a response, but that was no reason not to try. Brunetti called to the men at the bottom of the bridge.
"Can I come down?"
"Yes, sir. We've checked the area."
"You find anything?"
he asked as he started down the steps towards them.
"The usual stuff that's lying around on the street. Cigarette butts, a boat ticket, sweet wrapper."
"Don't forget the dog shit,"
said the other as he rose and put his hands on his hips and leaned backwards, as though hoping this would straighten out his back. To Brunetti, he added,
"That's the worst part of this job. There's not as much as there used to be, but there's still enough. More than enough."
Choosing to ignore this, Brunetti asked Ambrosio, who had come to stand beside him,
"That where he hit his head?"
Ambrosio nodded and pointed to a place on the pavement at the bottom of the bridge, where Brunetti saw a wide red stain.
"We found blood on the railing, sir," he said, indicating the place.
"Looks, to me at least, as if he hit his head there, then scraped it on the wall, and finally landed at the bottom and lay there bleeding until the guy saw him and called the hospital."
He accompanied this with a final gesture towards the landing at the bottom of the steps. Brunetti saw a red smear on the railing and another on the inner wall of the bridge, arguing in favor of the technician's reconstruction.
"You still have much to do?" he asked the other two men.
The taller one, who had been searching at the bottom of the bridge, answered,
"No, sir, not now that we've picked up everything. We've already taken prints from the railing and samples from those three places, so all we have to do is pack and clean up."
"Clean up how?"
Brunetti, wishing he could have resisted the temptation to ask.
"We keep a bucket in the boat, sir, with a rope. We can use the water from the canal to wash away the blood."
He spoke as casually as if he were giving street directions.
"After that, we'll go back to the Questura. If you wait 5 minutes, we can give you a ride."
"No, thanks," Brunetti answered. "I'm going to the hospital."
"We can drop you there on the way. No trouble."
It would be faster, Brunetti knew, just as he knew that in the Pronto Soccorso they had a coffee machine in their staff room. Brunetti had arrived in the wake of so many emergencies that the staff had come to view him as one of themselves and so let him use it, no matter what time he showed up.
"Thanks,"
Brunetti said, and moved towards the police launch that was tied to the wall beside the bridge. The boat got to the ambulance entrance of the hospital a bit after 3, the time of bad news. Brunetti thanked the pilot and stepped onto the landing. He made his way to Pronto Soccorso, where 8 people sat in chairs against the wall waiting their turn. The man at the reception desk recognized Brunetti and waved him through. Brunetti asked about the man who had been admitted with a head injury and was told that he was probably still in radiologia. There was no bed available for him at the moment. Before Brunetti could ask, the man told him to go and make himself a coffee. He'd probably find his colleague there. She'd come in from radiologia only a few minutes before. From force of habit, Brunetti knocked on the door of the staff room. He heard a chair scrape, feet approach, and then Grifoni opened the door and smiled at him. At 3 in the morning, drawn and tired, wearing no makeup, washed-out black jeans, brown shoes and falling-down socks, and a man's gray woolen sweater at least 3 sizes too big for her, she looked good enough for a photo shoot.
"I'm having a coffee,"
she said in greeting, then added,
"and saving my life."
She walked back to the table and drank what was left in her cup, then took it over and set it in the sink.
"The machine's still on. Would you like one?"
Brunetti saw no reason why he couldn't make his own coffee and was about to say so when she added,
"I'm not being a subservient woman, Guido. You look more tired than I feel."
"Then yes," Brunetti said. "Please."
He pulled out a chair and waited, silent, until she'd brought the coffee over to him, saying there was sugar in it already.
"Thanks, Claudia. I've been outside for a long time. Had no idea how cold it was."
"And damp. Don't forget the damp,"
she said, giving a very theatrical shiver, then pulling out a chair to sit opposite him.
"Did they find anything?"
she asked.
"The usual junk on the ground,"
he said, and took a sip.
"Horrible, isn't it?"
she said, when she saw his expression.
"If someone served that in Napoli, he'd be shot."
Brunetti finished the coffee and took the cup and saucer over to the sink.
"Tasted all right to me, but then if I were an alcoholic, I'd probably drink aftershave lotion."
"I think you just did,"
she answered. He smiled and leaned back against the sink.
"Tell me."
"He's about 50 and he's got a very bad concussion. The doctor isn't a neurologist, so he can't be more precise than that. He's got bruises and cuts on his head and face, probably from the fall, and the red marks I told you about on the inside of his wrist."
She took a few breaths and went on.
"Since I called you, the doctor said that the major damage is to the side of his head."
She paused, looking for the right word.
"He said there's a sort of dent in his skull."
Brunetti's eyes tightened at the word.
"He thinks it could have happened when his head hit the railing as he fell."
"What's his name?"
Brunetti asked, coming closer to the table.
"I don't know. He had a pair of house keys in his pocket, but no identification, and no coat."
"He probably lives around here," Brunetti said. "Can I see him?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"The nurses told me not to go back before 5. They're short-staffed as it is, and they don't want anyone on the ward who isn't a doctor or a patient."
"Did you try to—"
Even before he finished the question, she answered,
"I tried everything short of threats, but they mean it. The one I spoke to tried to be pleasant. It's the only time they have to enter patient information into the computer, and they really don't want anyone around."
Seeing that he was going to speak, Grifoni said,
"Trust me, Guido."
She looked at her watch and said,
"It's just a little more than an hour."
She tried to appear encouraging, but she sounded tired. He accepted the delay in front of them, and with that, either his adrenaline or his spirit failed him, and he was overcome with shaky exhaustion. He had been leaning forward, both hands propped on the back of one of the chairs at the table, but now he had to step around the chair and sit. He propped his elbows on the table, leaned forward, and put his face in his hands, rubbing at his eyes. Suddenly he wanted nothing more than to wash his face and hands with hot water. Grifoni got to her feet and said she was going to find a bathroom, but he didn't look at her. Indeed, he didn't even open his eyes. He heard the door close and put his arms on the table, his head on his arms. The next thing he knew, Claudia was saying his name, then he felt her hand on his shoulder.
Guido.
It's after 5. We can go up now. Silent, tired, the energy of the coffee long since disappeared, he followed Grifoni up to the radiology department. The nurse at the desk nodded to Grifoni as they came in.
He's still unconscious. Can we see him?
Grifoni asked. The nurse looked at Brunetti, who said, I'm police too. She nodded, and Grifoni walked past the desk and down the corridor. Towards the end, parked against the left side of the hallway, was a wheeled stretcher on which lay a blanket-covered form. Electrical wires sneaked out from under the blankets and slithered up a metal pole towards a fuse-box-looking thing at the top. Grifoni pointed with her chin and walked to the side of the bed. Brunetti came up beside her and looked down at the man on the stretcher. Lying there was the thick-haired man he had seen with Professoressa Crosera. Chapter 7
What is it?
Grifoni asked.
I know him, Brunetti answered. His wife came to talk to me a week ago.
About what?
Her son. She's afraid the boy's taking drugs.
Is he?
Grifoni had kept her voice low, and as they began to talk about the son, she backed a few steps away from the man on the stretcher. Brunetti followed her.
It could be. All she could tell me was that the boy was behaving strangely. Letting his schoolwork go, not paying attention to what was said to him.
Grifoni said, quite seriously,
Only that?
Brunetti shrugged.
Pretty much, he answered,
thinking back to what Professoressa Crosera had said to him, and to his own unwillingness to act on it.
What did you tell her?
I tried to explain that there wasn't much we could do. She wouldn't give me any concrete information. I wasn't even sure the behavior she described was due to drugs.
In response to Grifoni's skeptical expression, he said,
He's a 15-year-old boy, and he's become moody and unresponsive.
Grifoni nodded in understanding and agreement.
It's strange, but most of the parents I've talked to want to be told it's impossible. That there's no chance their child could...
She finished with a flourish of her hand, suggestive of all things parents did not want to know about their children. Brunetti glanced at the man. He lay on his back, head slightly tilted away, as though he wanted them to study the bandage that wrapped it in a drunken turban, on this side pulled down across his forehead and ear, on the other at least a hand's breadth above the ear. There was no telling what lay beneath the bandage, nor indeed under which part of it the wounds could be found. A cut sewn closed, a scrape disinfected and covered to keep it clean, a dent. There were rough places and scrapes on his face and a general puffiness around his eyes. He looked to be quietly asleep.
"Let me go and tell them who he is," Brunetti said.
He took out his notebook and paged through until he found the word Albertini. He glanced at his watch. It was 5:37, a time when a ringing phone presaged only pain.
"I'll call his wife," he told Grifoni.
She moved to sit on a chair at the foot of the bed so as not to block passage down the corridor. Brunetti went back to the nurse's desk and spoke to the duty nurse.
I think I know who he is.
The nurse smiled and said,
You police people work fast.
Too tired to joke, Brunetti nodded, as if to acknowledge what she had said as a compliment.
I've got his wife's number. I'll tell her he's here.
Seeing her confusion, he said, I know her, but I've never been introduced to him, so I don't know his name. He took out his telefonino, checked his notebook, and entered Professoressa Crosera's number. Nothing happened. Turning to the nurse, he said,
There's no reception here.
And walked back to Grifoni to explain about the phone.
Let's see if there's anyone at Rosa Salva. I'll call from the Campo.
As they emerged into Campo Santi Giovanni e Paolo, where the day was still not in evidence, Brunetti said,
I wonder if this was because of his son.
His steps slowed as he crossed the Campo, working out the possibilities and thinking of what he should have asked Professoressa Crosera. He stared up at the face of the statue of Colleone, and envied the man the determination and certainty carved into his features. He certainly would have had the truth out of her. He pressed redial, but still there was no reception. With his left hand he slapped on the glass door of Rosa Salva a few times before anyone came. Recognizing Brunetti, the barman opened the door to allow them to enter, closed, and locked it after them. Inside it was warm, the room rich with the sweetness of fresh-baked pastries. A young woman in a white baker's jacket and hat emerged from the room on the right with a tray of brioche, crossed behind the bar, and slipped the tray into place into the glass vitrine above the counter. Brunetti asked for two coffees. Smelling the pastries, he gave thanks for coffee and brioche, for sugar and butter and apricot marmalade, and a host of other things that were said to be bad for him. Years ago, Paola had scandalized him by saying she'd happily trade her right to vote for a washing machine. He realized he'd be tempted, at least this early in the day, to trade his for coffee and brioche. There was someone in the Old Testament who had traded his inheritance for a dish of something called pottage. The passage had always troubled Brunetti, who surely would have read it with greater understanding if the trade had been for coffee and brioche. Turning to Grifoni, he asked, pointing to the tray of pastries,
"If the devil asked you to trade your soul for a coffee and one of those, would you do it?"
The coffees came, along with two brioche on a plate. Taking a napkin, she picked one up, sipped at her coffee, and took a bite.
"First, I'd try to get him to settle for 3 euros instead," she said, and took another bite, another sip. "But if he refused, I'd probably agree."
"Me too,"
Brunetti said, and began to eat, happy that fate had sent him such a compatible colleague. When he finished his coffee, he told Grifoni he'd try again to make the call. She pulled out her wallet, placed a note on the counter, and asked for another coffee. Brunetti waved his thanks and went outside. Feeling the first buzz from the sugar and the caffeine, Brunetti took his phone from his pocket and entered Professoressa Crosera's number. The phone rang once before it was answered by a woman who asked, voice tight with fear or anger,
"Tullio, is that you?"
"Professoressa Crosera?" Brunetti asked.
Wary now, she asked,
"Who is this?"
"Commissario Guido Brunetti, signora," he began. "I'm calling from the hospital. Your husband is here."
"My husband?"
"Yes," he said, keeping his voice even. "He's here, in radiologia."
"What happened?"
she asked. When she said no more, Brunetti listened and heard her taking deep breaths.
"It appears he fell on a bridge and hit his head. That's why he's in radiologia. They've taken some x-rays and are deciding what to do next."
Brunetti did not know if this was true or not, but it might calm her to believe that the hospital had things under control.
"How is he?"
"As I said, signora, the doctors don't have a clear idea yet," Brunetti explained, thinking it better not to mention what the admitting doctor had said.
"Have you spoken to him?"
she surprised him by saying.
"No, signora. He hasn't regained consciousness yet."
Before he could continue, she said,
"I'm coming,"
and she was gone. He immediately dialed Vianello's number. When the inspector answered, sounding fully awake, Brunetti explained,
"I'm at the hospital. The husband of that woman who came to me about her son last week, Crosera, fell down a bridge last night, perhaps with some help from another person. He's in radiologia. I'll be here until the neurologist has a look at him."
"What can I do?"
Vianello said without asking for more information.
"Speak to Il Gazzettino and La Nuova. Tell them a man, no name, was found at the bottom of the steps, Ponte del Forner, over by Capesaro. Tell them to request that anyone who was in the area around midnight call us if they heard or saw anything."
"What else?"
"When she gets in, ask Signorina Elettra to take a look at Crosera and her husband, if she can find his name."
"Usual stuff?" Vianello asked.
"Yes. Any strange friends?
Any strange anything?
Check the son, Alessandro. See if he's ever had any trouble with us."
"How old is he?"
15.
"Then the information would be sealed, because he's a minor."
"Lorenzo,"
Brunetti said in the tone of voice with which one would reproach a child,
"ask Signorina Elettra to do it."
"Of course."
Through the silent connection, he could all but hear Vianello putting all of this together. Finally, the inspector said,
"His wife tells you the son is taking drugs. Then the father slips and falls on a bridge, and you want us to find out what we can about him and his wife."
"You're forgetting the son, Lorenzo," Brunetti said pleasantly.
"Of course, the son. If he didn't slip and fall, then it's related to something he did, so for now let's have a look."
"I realize that, Guido,"
Vianello said with a brusqueness that suggested he might not yet have had coffee.
"You've excluded a mugging?"
he asked, but his heart wasn't in the question.
"What would a mugger do outside at midnight in November, Lorenzo?"
"All right, Guido. I'll take care of this and see you when you get to the Questura."
"Thanks, Lorenzo."
"What are you going to do?"
"Go back to radiology and wait for his wife."
"Right,"
Vianello said, and was gone. The day was growing lighter, and it looked as though the fog had disappeared. Would they see the sun today, that bright, friendly disk that had been so long absent? Grifoni had been waiting in the campo while he was speaking to Vianello. Standing still, she was facing the east. The increasing light coming from behind the basilica illuminated her face. Brunetti, always a sucker for feminine beauty, liked what he saw, but he also saw the dark signs of tiredness beneath her eyes.
"What time did you go to bed?"
he asked, as though it were the most normal question for him to ask.
"Midnight, I think,"
she said, and turned away from the growing light, thus wiping away the smudges he had seen.
"The call came at 1?
He asked, relentless.
"About then, but I'm fine."
"Why don't you go home for a couple of hours?"
Giving her no chance to object, he said,
"They'll need some time to check things."
When she still seemed unconvinced, he added,
"Besides, you probably won't be of much use to anyone."
"In my current state, you mean?"
"If that's what led you to put on brown shoes with black trousers, yes."
She looked at her feet, as though he told her that her shoes were on fire, and said,
"Oh, Dio! How did that happen?"
"Go home, Claudia," he said seriously. "I'll see you later."
Chapter 8 When he got to the hospital, Brunetti was told that no ward had yet been found with an empty bed for the injured man, who thus remained in the corridor. He asked a passing nurse if a doctor had been to see the patient yet, but none had. He sat on a chair at the end of the bed and folded